When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I'm not sure there are a lot of people necessarily saying it's the best way to do it, only it's the way we've got, and trying to create a whole new way of doing it would require some kind of agreement between the parties on how they were going to do that. And American politics is so divided at the moment that that's just not possible.
Hello and welcome to America, a history podcast. I'm your host, Liam Heffernan, and every week we answer a different question to understand the people, the places, and the events that have shaped the USA into the country it is today. This week, as the nomination contests for the 2024 presidential election get fully underway, I want to find out a little more about how it all works as I ask, what is a primary and a caucus? And joining me from the faculty this week is Dr. Emma Long, Associate Professor of American History and Politics and the head of the Department of American Studies at the University of East Anglia. Hello, Emma.
Hi, Liam.
It's really good to have you back on the podcast.
Good to be here.
Yeah, I feel like this is going to be the first of many times that we talk about this over the coming months.
Yeah, I have a feeling that regular listeners are going to feel like the election has been going on for years, which is how the rest of us feel most of the time.
Well, I mean, you know, we're recording this kind of end of January 2024. New Hampshire primary has just happened. So people are already saying the general election has basically started, because I think no presidential, or at least no Republican presidential candidate has won both the Iowa and New Hampshire caucus and primary, and gone on to lose the nomination, from what I understand.
May well be true, yeah.
And at this present time, Trump has just won both of those. Nikki Haley's still in the race, as far as we know, as they head into South Carolina. But, I mean, everyone's talking now about Trump versus Biden. So, yeah, election is on, really.
Yeah, and that's one of the weird things, right? I think we talked before, when we talked about presidential elections, about the fact that there's these two periods, right? The first period, this is the primary period, and the main general election doesn't get started until August, after the party conventions. But like you say, because there's no major challenger to Joe Biden, so he's sort of the presumptive nominee, and because as we record this, it looks like it'll be Trump for the Republicans. I mean, in fairness, as it has for quite some time at this point. Yes, they're going to be going, you know, they're going to be fighting it out through the primaries, but ultimately they're not fighting against others in their party. They're now just fighting against each other. So an election, a general election that's supposed to run for, what, 3 months, is now going to run for closer to 10. Mm. And we wonder why Americans are sort of fed up with elections, right? They're getting this constantly for 11 months. I easily see why some of them get to election day and go, I'm not going out to vote. I've had enough.
Yeah, and you know, when you think about it, the actual like window, as you say, for the main kind of general election campaigning happens after the conventions, which is in the summer. So that's actually quite a small window. You look at the process that comes before that. I mean, candidates are putting their hats in the race, you know, anything up to like 18 months before. Ron DeSantis hasn't even been living in Florida for the last year, and he's the governor of the state because he was so focused on trying to win, and then he drops out after the first caucus. So it's a long process, and we covered it a little bit when we chatted to John Sopel in one of our earliest episodes, to go and check that out. But this episode particularly, I wanted to just dive a little bit deeper into that process, because it takes so much longer than the actual general election campaign. So how does it work?
Oh, there's a big question. I think the first thing to remember in many ways is, although this is about the presidential election, because of the way presidential elections work through the Electoral College, the presidential election isn't a national election, it's 50 state elections. So what you've got in primary season is candidates vying to be the nominee for the party in 50 state elections, not one national election. And they have to get nominated by the 50 state parties, which is what the primaries and caucuses are. So you've got 50 of them. That takes some time. I mean, there are lots of reasons why the process takes this long historically, because if candidates needed to go and convince people to try and vote for them, you know, they didn't have instant media and all the rest of what we have now. So, you know, they had to travel from place to place to try and convince the great and the good of their party, not the general public. We'll come to this in a second, but they had to travel and convince people at a time when travel took longer. So, you know, you've got a practical reason. But in the modern era with media and all the rest of it, one of the reasons is the states vie for like being earlier or later on, right? It's prestige to have an early primary or an early caucus. You get a lot of attention in the state. It brings people to the state. And actually for candidates, particularly smaller candidates, we haven't seen that in a little while perhaps, but for smaller candidates, those early states, places like Iowa and New Hampshire, they're smaller, they cost less money to get a campaign organized. So for people who perhaps have less name recognition and haven't been able to raise money, they can try and build up some momentum in these early states and then work their way through. So I mean, people like Jimmy Carter, remember you had a podcast about Carter. He was relatively unknown outside of his state when he ran for president in the 1970s. But what he did was he managed to build momentum from these smaller states. Even Bill Clinton, obviously elected in 1992, wasn't really well known outside of his home state of Arkansas. So candidates can use that process to their advantage. So there's a historical reason and sort of a practical one in terms of the way that it now works. And of course, it benefits increasingly candidates because they get more and more media coverage, you know, as they win, not so good if you lose, but you know, those who are more successful, they get media coverage that brings more people hopefully to their campaign. It helps them raise money, which means they get onto the next stage. And so there's no real pressure to condense primary period.
Yeah, but I mean running a nomination campaign is expensive.
Like, oh, hugely expensive.
You need those donors, don't you? And like Ron DeSantis, I think I heard somewhere, because he of the amount of votes that he got in the Iowa caucus and the amount of money that he spent campaigning just in that state alone, I think someone worked out that he paid roughly $6,000 per vote and still only came in second.
Sounds about right. Yeah. This is the nature of American elections, and especially those early ones. Again, that idea that if you can either win the early ones or do better than expected in those early ones, the story then becomes about you and you can build that momentum. So a lot of money per vote effectively goes into those early campaigns in the hope that they can do that. Obviously in DeSantis's case, it really didn't pay off. Historically for others, they say, you know, Carter and Clinton, among others, it has been a more successful tactic. But yeah, I mean, something like the last presidential election cycle, so 2000, the cost of both the presidential election and the congressional elections that happened, the total amount of money spent in that election cycle was something like $16 billion. It's just, sometimes I think the American economy would collapse if they didn't have an election like this every 4 years. Just the sheer amount of money, but it gives you an idea of what people feel is at stake and how much they're spending.
But then, of course, you know, you've got to think, when you break down that sort of $16 billion and whatever it is, you know, every year, there are some big companies that give money to both sides because they're hedging their bets, right? Because it's all politics, you know, they're making sure that they win over the right people. So it's madness because then you're essentially kind of cancelling it out.
Yeah, I think that there's a whole podcast to be done on campaign finance in the United States. I think it's both misunderstood in some ways and massively important for understanding how it works.
Yeah, well, there's a future appearance for you there, Emma. I'll come to that one. Let's reiterate for people who maybe didn't listen to our earlier episode or have just gotten confused again, because it's so easy to when you kind of dive into American politics. What actually is a primary and a caucus? What's the difference between the two?
Okay, so both of them are in effect a party's way of determining who's going to be their candidate. Right? Here in the UK, we have a similar system, but it's done much more quietly. So, for example, if there's a constituency that it needs a new MP, there will be a selection process of people who want to stand for that seat. But it's done sort of within the party. It's not an open vote and all of those kinds of things. So a primary and a caucus, in many ways, at its heart, is not that dissimilar from that process, right? Somebody, there's one job going, somebody wants it, or lots of people want it, you've got to work out who's going to get it. And this is the way that has come. Differences between the two. Caucuses, there are relatively few of them these days, but caucuses are much more like the way that presidential candidates were picked in history, which is sort of it's the party, it's the members of the party, sort of the often the great and the good of the party. Almost, I don't want to mischaracterize the modern one, but if you think about those like smoke-filled, white, male-dominated rooms of the past where like the party leaders got together to discuss who they wanted to be their candidate. Mm. That's how it works historically. And caucuses are sort of a slightly evolved version of that. So they have meetings in person. People have to go along in person to those meetings and they vote in those meetings. We're not talking secret ballots or anything like that. It's a kind of show of hands discussion followed by a show of hands debate. This is why actually this year in the Iowa caucus, which was the first for the Republicans, there was such a big debate because they'd got this kind of massive cold spell and temperatures were like minus 30 degrees Celsius. Mm. And, you know, there was a lot of discussion about how many people were going to come out because those kinds of temperatures are dangerous. So, but that's a caucus, if you like. People physically going to a meeting room to discuss and then vote. Mm. A primary is much more like the elections we're more familiar with. Generally, people cast a ballot and then they are collected up and counted in that way. Primaries are actually relatively recent for all the talk and how much time we spend looking at them. Primaries really didn't exist before the beginning of the 20th century. They were fairly sparse through most of the 20th century. There were a few states that had them, most didn't. The real change is the Democratic Party convention in Chicago in 1968 is famous for a lot of very bad reasons, partly because it was the height of the Vietnam War, the anti-war protests. A lot of anti-war protesters turned up sort of in opposition to Lyndon Johnson, even though Lyndon Johnson wasn't standing for election that year. But they turn up in Chicago. Mayor Daley wants to make a big play of having the convention in Chicago and that he's cleaned up the city and all of this. That there's sort of over-policing of protesters and minority groups, and there's a lot of violence outside the convention hall. There's a really good movie that tells a story of some of these by Aaron Sorkin. It's called The Trial of the Chicago Seven, worth a watch. But it sort of tells some or part of the story around that. But so there's chaos going on outside the convention, and inside the convention, the Democratic Party is deeply divided between sort of carrying on with the Vietnam War and trying to see it through to its end, and sort of the anti-Vietnam War protesters. So you've got Hubert Humphrey, who's sort of the pro-war candidate, for want of a better term, and on the other side of that battle, you've got Eugene McCarthy, who's sort of very much the anti-war candidate. You also before that had Robert Kennedy, who was assassinated only a couple of months before the convention. Humphrey hadn't entered any of the Democratic primaries that year, yet he's the one who at the convention wins the nomination. Mm. And there's such it's chaos on the floor of the convention, of these debates going backwards and forwards. And after that, the Democrats sort of have a big sort of rethink. There's a commission set up to rethink, because it wasn't good for anybody. It didn't look good for the party. It wasn't good for voters. And they introduce, ultimately what comes of that is the introduction from the 1972 election of more primaries. And then because they do that, sort of the Republicans end up nudging in that direction as well. So primaries really, like I said, early 20th century was about, part of the progressive movement was about fairer elections. So trying to break the control of like the party machines and the kind of the heads of the party, and to give ordinary voters a bit more of a say, comes along with other reforms like bringing in the referendum and also the secret ballot, actually, is part of some of that earlier movement. So that changes the beginning of it. But it's not until actually relatively recently, nearly not quite my lifetime, but almost from the 1970s, that primaries really become dominant in the process of choosing candidates.
But okay, so all 50 states have either a primary or a caucus, and then the winner goes to the convention in the summer and gets formally nominated. But you mentioned about how, you know, these were kind of brought in to sort of democratize the process a little bit more and take kind of some sort of less, I guess, discretionary power away from the sort of the party heads. But am I right in thinking that the parties aren't bound to the results of the primaries and caucuses? If the delegates from each state went to the convention in the summer, they're not in any way, you know, legally or obligated to nominate the candidate that the primary and caucus has chosen. They can still go and pick someone else, can't they?
Not so much these days. Historically, yes, that was the case. Increasingly, the delegates that voted for the convention are increasingly bound by the terms of the party requirements to vote for the candidates. Each state is different. This is the other thing to remember about these, which is because it's 50 state primaries, everyone is different and everyone has its own rules and regulations. So it's hard to generalize too much about it. But generally speaking, those candidates are bound to those delegates at the convention are bound to vote for the candidates, unless certain things happen at the convention. You know, if there's, then they become unbound from that. But you also have to remember that it's not, primaries generally are not necessarily winner takes all. So the Democrats at their primaries, say, obviously this year we're just talking about Biden, but in previous years where they've been two or three candidates the year when Obama and Clinton were running, for example, in their primaries, the delegates they get are distributed based on the proportion of the vote that they get in the primaries. So if somebody may not win but might come close, that's important because it determines the number of delegates. The Republicans work it slightly differently. So this year at least, and again, it can change every year, every election cycle, but for this 2024 cycle, Republicans distribute delegates proportionately up for primaries up until, I think it's the 15th of March. And then for primaries and caucuses that happen after that, the person who wins gets all of the delegates. I think working on the fact that date, you have a sense of who the front runner is going to be. So Historically, yes. I mean, historically, the conventions were the time where all of the delegates met, and they really did work out who the candidate was going to be. There were votes on the floor of the convention, and there was bargaining going on both behind the scenes and in front of them, and people were really working out who candidates would be, increasingly because of the way the primaries now work and the coverage that they get. The conventions, they do important business in terms of what the platform is going to be, what the campaign strategies are going to be for the party, if not specifically for the candidate. But it's much more of a publicity show, right? It's the crowning of the candidate and sending them off into the general election to say, we've had this messy process where there's been lots of infighting. Now we're all coming together behind the person who won. And now we're all going to get behind that person before they go try and beat the other guy. So, yeah, again, it's that historical change.
I just want to pick up on your point there about now, obviously, people are more bound to honour the results of the primaries and caucuses. We're assuming that that system works, right? That somehow that's more effective, that we're democratising the vote. But the Republican Party, case in point, 1860, presumably there wasn't the primaries and the caucuses. They put forward Abraham Lincoln. 2016... primaries and caucuses are there, they're in full effect, they nominate Donald Trump. There's an argument there that perhaps they're not as effective as they're meant to be, right?
I mean, there would have been some people who, if you'd have asked them in 1860, would have told you that Abraham Lincoln was the worst thing to happen to the country, of course. Civil War followed. Point. So, there were differences of opinion, but I take your point. And I don't know. I mean, there's been a lot of discussion amongst academics, amongst political commentators. You only have to do a pretty quick search online, right, to find journalists and academics and commentators, right, writing articles about, you know, the broken primary system and how it favours one group over another, or, you know, it's open to not corruption exactly, but it's open to unfair influence, and that there would definitely these days be better ways to run this. So I don't know, like a lot of the American system of government, I'm not sure there are a lot of people necessarily saying it's the best way to do it, only it's the way we've got, and trying to create a whole new way of doing it would require some kind of agreement between the parties on how they were going to do that. And American politics is so divided at the moment that that's just not possible. So like many things, there's a legacy there of how things work. And I think, you know, the progressive movement in the early 20th century had a point, right? When you look at what happened with voting practices before that, before the secret ballot, where people just like turned up to a room and put their hands up and got counted, you know, it's the era of the what we call the party machines, where, you know, there's fraud and graft and corruption and whole stories of this. If anybody's listening is interested in this, I mean, it's a fascinating history. The famous one is Tammany Hall out of New York City, of the political machines. But the progressives wanted to clean up politics, and in the context of the politics of their day, this was a good way of doing it, of ordinary voters being able to actually have a say in who the candidates were. And especially in some parts of the country, determining who the candidate was equivalent to determining who the person who got elected was. So for a long time through the 20th century, the Democrats were so dominant in the South, for example, that if you were running on the Democratic ticket for, say, state level thing, you were going to get elected because the Democrats were so dominant. So it did give people a say, but elections have changed since then. Technology has changed, the nature of politics has changed, the media has changed. Money has become much more of an issue. So, you know, the ideas were right then, but maybe not necessarily so much now.
And so, you know, we've been talking about this up to now in the context of, you know, Democrats versus Republicans. And that's, I mean, that's very much how American politics has shaped up. But it's almost a two-party system by design, because the Democrats and the Republicans have gotten big enough that they can kind of squeeze out other candidates from the race. So I'm just wondering, you know, if we look beyond just the main two parties, are sort of other independent candidates and other smaller political parties bound by the same nomination process?
No, I mean, the thing to remember, one of the things I think to remember about the primary and caucus system is it's not a constitutional thing. Right? When the founders wrote the constitution back in the late 18th century, they thought parties were a really bad thing. And they didn't really predict in many ways that that was what was going to happen, even though it came really quickly. So primaries are in many ways sort of, they're not state events. This sounds a bit confusing, but for much of American history, parties were private organizations organizing their own internal business, and they then put them forward for the elections that were state business. And actually, for much of American history, that's how the parties justified racial exclusion. So finding ways to prevent non-white voters from voting, because they would say, well, we're a private organization. We're not governed by the terms of the Constitution. We can dictate who our own members were, and we don't want people who aren't white. And in some cases, they were that blunt about it. Of course, as the civil rights movement really begins to come into force, and you get groups like the NAACP, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, who also emerge sort of in that same era of the progressive movement, fighting for voting rights for people of color. They begin to try and find ways of challenging this. And one of the things they're really successful in is getting the Supreme Court to recognize that although these parties are private organizations, when they are doing things that have something to do with elections, like primaries, they sort of become semi-state organizations because of the link to what comes next in that process. So it takes a while for that to happen, but they are still effectively not private but sort of semi-private organizations by parties organizing their own internal business. If you've got a third party candidate, I mean, the obvious one who comes to my mind, because he was sort of the most successful, was Ross Perot in 1992. He didn't represent the party. He sort of decided to run for himself. He didn't have to go through those kinds of processes because he's his own. He's not standing on behalf of a party. Yeah. So, you know, independent candidates like that are not bound by the same processes. But of course, the primary system now gets so much media coverage that if you're not doing something like that, it's going to be very hard to sort of feed into that media story. So, you know, maybe one of the things that if you were thinking about changing it, it's not just about changing the primary system, it's about changing the way that the media cover it.
It's kind of feeds into my next thought, which was all around the sort of the longevity of the like nominations campaign, because it is very drawn out, and I don't really understand why this can't just be one day nationwide polling, just like it is on the general election. You know, if they can do it to elect the president, then surely they can organize it on one day to elect the nominees, right? And yet it takes so much time, so much money, so much resource, and months of just organized state by state, you know, primaries and caucuses. Like, you know, take this year, Iowa was what, middle of January? The final primary won't be until what, May, June?
Something like that, yeah.
Like it's madness to me. Why not just combine all the nomination sort of primaries and caucuses into one day and have a longer general election campaign period where you can kind of galvanize your resources as a party, but you can also kind of campaign on a national level so much more effective without tearing your party apart with infighting between candidacy nominees?
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense. I don't necessarily disagree with you. Like I said, historically, I think there are reasons why it was spread out for practical reasons. Some people, again, as you said, have a vested interest in it because there are a small number of people who've been very successful at building that momentum from the earlier ones into the later ones, which you wouldn't get if they were all on one day. Mm. You know, for candidates that perhaps don't already have name recognition, that all on one day thing maybe doesn't work. Although if you have a bigger run-up to it, with people sort of running campaigns up to that point, that might mitigate against some of that. But yes, it's back to that point that it's been done like this for so long. Trying to get something this big and sort of this entrenched, trying to convince people to change it is extremely hard. People might not like it. And lots of people say they don't. And, you know, you ask Americans, do a survey of Americans around May time and ask them how they think about the election. And they'll tell you that they're sick to death of it by that point. And there's still months to go. But again, when you start trying to talk about change, people get very antsy about those things. So all of which is not to say that they shouldn't rethink it, only to try and explain why they don't.
And I guess, you know, the challenges with trying to change anything here is exactly the same as we've discussed before about anything sort of legal in America, is that you've got this sort of tug of war constantly between federal and state. And actually, it feels like from what you're saying that there is really no kind of federal jurisdiction over how states choose or how each party chooses their nominee in each state. So it's not a case of just saying, let's change it and make a better system. It's you have to convince your party in 50 different states to change the way that they elect and choose their nominee,
yep.
Right?
Yeah. And under the terms of the Constitution, states have control over how their elections work. So even for the presidential election, it is a statewide election and every state sets their own terms. And I think we've mentioned this in the podcast before, but everything from where polling stations can be to what hours they open to whether you can vote by post to what kind of ID you need to take to be able to vote, it's different in every state. So yes, there is no, it's not something that the federal government can change because elections are state run.
And I think there's definitely a conversation to be had near the election around kind of the mechanics of the election day, I guess, and sort of the issues there around kind of voter suppression and with the way it's sort of currently run.
There's definitely a whole podcast on that.
Certainly. But when we look particularly at the primaries and the caucuses, so to kind of whistle stop summarize, so essentially every state has its own process, which is sort of tied together by kind of the higher party code of conduct and ways of doing things. And delegates are then bound to honor the results of each of their states' processes when they go to the convention. And it's at the convention in the summer that the party's nominee is then chosen. So I guess my final question is, does it actually work? And is there a better way forward?
Does it work? I mean, at a basic level, yes, it does, because you get candidates to run in the election. You know, there's that. Do you get the best candidates there's a whole other question, and a lot of people would say no, especially in this current election cycle where they look at Biden and Trump and think these are the two best candidates your parties can put forward out of all of the possibilities that there may be. So that, yeah, there's a question there. I think I've said before on this, I'm a historian. I deal with what happened in the past. I get very uncomfortable when people try and ask me how it should be or what it might be in the future. There are other ways of electing candidates, right? You know, half the world this year has an election of some kind, and every country runs a slightly different process. So there are other examples out there that the United States could look to if it was inclined to reform the election system. I just don't think anybody's prepared to take on the challenge that's that big, particularly not in the current climate.
Yeah. And I think it does beg the question of if America is just settling for a process that they know isn't the most effective at selecting the best candidate, but if they don't go with what they have, they'd end up having no candidate because it's such a divisive country. Without just having the process the way it is, it just feels like it's not about having the most democratic process. It's just about having the most agreeable one, is how it feels.
Yeah, very possibly. And of course, again, the common theme in our sort of political podcasts has been to talk about the fact that American politics is so polarized at the moment. The rhetoric from both sides is so polarized. So the additional problem that you would have at the moment in terms of reforming it would be finding a system where one side or the other didn't suggest that it benefited one more than the other. Mm. At least with the system that they've got, they're both equally bad, because they're both using more or less the same system. So neither of them particularly has an advantage when it comes to the general election part of this. But yeah, I mean, there's something about, I don't know, on one hand, you could argue that it's really democratic. In thinking particularly, say, about the 2016 nomination where Trump sort of came to the fore, but there were lots of Republican nominees that year, and there were debates and those kinds of things. On one hand, you can argue that's democracy in action, right? There are lots of candidates. People get to hear from all of them, and then they get to vote. It's not done behind closed doors. It's not done by the elites. It's done openly, and ordinary people have a say. That if you like, that's one side of the argument, and sort of that maybe the slightly idealistic side. The kind of pragmatic one is to look at what happened of that and go, is it really good for the party to have these people knocking 10 bells out of each other before they get to the general election? At which point they go, well, we've just given our opponents all the best lines about how to attack us, and now we're going to try and sort of claim that we didn't do that. So which is
exactly
problems.
What Joe Biden did. Like, he's taken Nikki Haley's speech from her New Hampshire loss and turned it into a promotional video against Trump for the Democrats. Like, that's exactly what's happened.
Yeah. And of course, it's particularly that happens particularly in the situation where we are now, where there's an incumbent in one party who's not being challenged. I mean, not in any major way. But then you've got challenges in the other party. If both of them have got lots of candidates, then they're all fighting it out amongst themselves. It's sort of equal. But when you've got this imbalance, yeah, exactly. You're suddenly giving your opponents leverage.
Yeah. Well, on that note, I think there's so much more to unpack, not just about the nominations process, but about the entire US electoral process. And I'm sure as we carry on through this crazy year, we're going to sort of unpack that more and more on this podcast. But I think we're going to have to wrap up for now on this particular episode. So thank you so much, Emma, for joining me. And if you want to find out more, to anyone listening, we've left some useful links in the show notes. So go check out those. And Emma, if anyone wants to connect with you or get in touch, how can they do that?
Probably best to find me through the University of East Anglia.
Wonderful. And you can find me on X via This Is The Hef and on LinkedIn. just search for me, Liam Heffernan. And if you enjoy the podcast, please leave us a rating and a review wherever you're listening to this. And give us a follow as well so that all future episodes appear in your feed. Thanks very much and goodbye.
Hi, my name is Kay Adams, and to be honest, I'm not so good with the aging process, so I enlisted my old chum, the filter-free Cara McKenzie, to advise.
Could you imagine being a porn star? The room would need to be really hot for me to strip off.
To be honest, she's not much help, but she is rather amusing. And along with some great guests, Joe Brand, Andy Oliver, Anton Dubek, Ruth Langsford, and Craig Revel Horwood, darling, we are learning how to be 60. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.